Shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom. Be shalom, shalom.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show, you just heard a little bit of a teaser there. It's called Peace, Shalom, Shalom by Emma's Revolution. And I think you probably are familiar with this sound. Yep, you know it. Those are the bees that are buzzing around in my bonnet tonight. I know you're probably sick and tired of hearing about the government shutdown and the debt ceiling. I've even stopped watching the news myself as much as I usually do the last couple days, though I do keep an ear out to see if there's been any progress. But, you know, what's really got the hornets angry in my bonnet is this false equivalency that it's equally the fault of both sides. That's totally untrue, if that's what you've been hearing. The Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, if you know, they're both called that, it is law. Then there are ways to change laws. But, yes, you have to have a majority of people to change the law. That's what democracy is all about. We don't like Citizens United, but did we threaten to shut down the government to get rid of it? No. We're taking the long, painstaking route one takes in a democracy to change a law. Do we want women to have to endure vaginal penetration against their will with these Republican-mandated vaginal probes? No, but we know we have to change the rules when we get the majority of votes. That's how a democracy works. As independent Bernie Sanders said, if President Obama caves into this, what's next? These Tea Party people are financed by the 1%, the Koch brothers, and that sort. They're people who don't believe in government. And as Bernie said, what would be next? Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, unemployment insurance, anything that's security for the poor, elderly, and middle class could be gone. And just so you know, Democrats have already caved to deep sequester cuts, which are hurting people around the country. These sequester cuts are very close to the Paul Ryan budget, so who's winning and won't take their victory and be happy with it? You know, I hate to use this word, it sounds like hyperbole, but this feels like blackmail. There's more at stake than Obamacare. Our democracy is at stake. Millionaires and billionaires who want to destroy the social safety net should not be allowed to buy a Congress and hold the country hostage to destroy programs that help the poor and the middle class, and that's what they're doing. Like it or not, this is class warfare. Society should not be a survival of the fittest scenario where the strong or the rich dominate or make slaves of the week. Have we not evolved past that yet? Are we not in this together? I guess in some places they still think that should be the law of the land. So I guess to conclude, the next time you hear some reporter like Chuck Todd the other day say it's not his job to advise people of Republican lies that distort the dialogue out there, well, you know better. No, that's a journalist's job, to tell the unbiased truth to the public. That's what they're there for. Know that the president should not have to repeal a law, that Republicans should use the rules that have always been in place to change the law if they don't like it and they don't have support for it. Then they'll just have to live with it if they don't have support with it, just like we're living with all the stuff they shove down our throat. So sorry for that. I've just had it up to my eyeballs with their bullying, their hostage-taking, and, yes, their extortion. They're damaging citizens and the economy. And I'm sick and tired of their anti-woman, anti-science, anti-gay, anti-immigrant, anti-environment, anti-social security and Medicare, anti-worker mentality. Sick and tired of it. And I hope enough people are sick and tired of it so we can take back the House of Representatives and get some legislation that will create jobs, get fairer taxes so the rich pay their fair share, repair the huge holes in our social safety net, restore upward mobility to the middle class and poor so we don't have this huge, huge income inequality gap that we have. We are worse off than 35 or 40 countries when you compare this. It's really an obscene shame. So, those are the bees buzzing around in my bonnet today. So, turning my attention to tonight's show, first up I have with us Janet Binion discussing feminist polygamy, polyandry, and why this kind of marriage arrangement does actually work for some women and what legislation might be appropriate. Then at 7 o'clock, award-winning French-Lebanese writer, producer, and director Sula Saad will discuss her project Feminitude and the Sacred Feminine in the Middle East, actually the unheard feminine voice in the Middle East. It's the first of 8 films. But first, one last announcement. If you're in the New York area, there will be a screening of the movie or documentary Femme, Women Healing the World. If you're in that area and you want to find out if it's somewhere near you and convenient, go to the Facebook page for Femme, F-E-M-M-E, for more details. Also, if you've not been able to attend a screening, the film can now be downloaded for $4.99. This is really a must-see documentary for everyone. It needs to be required learning. It needs to saturate living rooms and theaters across the world. Femme, Women Healing the World by Emmanuel Etier of Wonderland Entertainment, executive produced by Sharon Stone. And now to our first guest, Janet Binion. Let me tell you a bit about her before we begin what I believe will be a fascinating and very enlightening conversation. Janet is a professor of anthropology at Linden State College in Vermont, specializing in Mormon fundamentalist polygamy. She has a PhD in anthropology from University of Utah and a master's in social anthropology from Portland State University. Her scientific publications include Polygamy in Prime Time by the University of Brandeis Press, which provides a history and impact of polygamy in North America. Also, Women of Principle, Female Networking in Contemporary Mormon Polygamy by Oxford University Press, which is the first ethnography ever published about Mormon fundamentalism and provides female conversion narratives. And Desert Patriarchy, published by University of Arizona Press, which presents her theory explaining the role of the desert environment in Chihuahua, Mexico specifically, and the development and maintenance of a patriarchal gender ideology. She spent 20 years living among and researching communities of fundamentalists, presenting papers all over the world on how the media often dismisses the enormous variability hidden in poly family lifestyles. This data is essential to informing policy on legislating marriage rules for this new marriage frontier. So, Janet, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I was delighted to hear that you mentioned Bernie Sanders. He's our great senator from Vermont. We're so proud of him.
I love Bernie.
And,
you should know that
Vermont has been on the forefront of marriage rights. You remember that they were one of the first to pass the civil union, and then just recently, 2 years ago, year and a half ago, they made it full law for gay marriage. And so who knows what we'll see next with Vermont. They typically
I know.
Set the...
Well, you know, I've been reading, all of these articles on the Internet about what's really behind this government shutdown, and so many of it, and you may, have some thoughts on this, because, so much of it seems to be about dominionist Christianity, which, at least in my mind, is so, it's sort of rubs up against, fundamentalism. If the people have to depend on the government, they'll worship the government as God and not God, which is so ridiculous.
One of the problems within, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, but one of the problems within polygamy is some of the most abusive forms of polygamy come from some of the dominant gender dichotomy forms of polygamy that are much more rigid, such as those that are associated with the FLDS or Warren Jeffs group. But you must recognize that there's a lot of variability within polygamy now. I mean, just recently we've had Brady Williams, who's the son of one of my key informants, come out in prime time with his My Five Wives show. And this is typical of many independent polygamists now who are much more progressive, much more open to having the wives actually rule the show. And this is something that we've got to recognize. It's not just, you know, one uniform depiction of polygamy now that often is associated with rigid fundamentalism. Now polygamy, polyamory is, you know, seen in all kinds of faces.
Right. Well, and let's talk about all of that, too, because, you know, really, well, look, wasn't it HBO had Big Love or something like that?
Right. Uh-huh.
I have to admit, I didn't really watch it, so
oh,
I can't really say much about it. But you know, so that seemed, though, to put a positive face on polygamy, did it not?
Well, yeah, what it did, and your listeners should know that it was actually created by two gay men who wrote it, and they not only took into consideration the Darger family, but some of my ethnography about the Williams family came to light. And so what you see in HBO is a perfect medley of reality. You've got, you know, the sort of isolated, more rigid patriarchal groups in the South on the border of Arizona and Utah. And then you've got the more progressive independence in areas like South Salt Lake that actually, you know, have women who are empowered, who really do, like I said, run the show and in many ways benefit from this enormous female network that is provided. For example, you know, in the Brady family with his five wives, two of the wives work outside the home. Two are actually studying to get their college degrees. You know, so what they're doing is they're using each other as bulwarks to gain their own careers, to be able to take care of their children, so that this network really provides a very strong social, economic, emotional foundation for their lives. And that is something that people should recognize, and it's primetime television shows that's bringing this out.
Well, and I want to address
that. HBO
did that,
but Sister Wives, too.
Well, that's
TLC's
what I was going to ask
Wives.
You. Talk about that one a little bit, because I haven't even heard about that. Is that on right now?
You know, I haven't been paying attention to it recently, but for the past couple of years, Sister Wives has paraded the Cody Brown family with his four wives, you know, and one of the most fascinating parts of the show was the adoption of a fourth wife, Robin. And this started about 2 years ago when Cody Brown was living in Lehi, Utah. Now the family has moved to Nevada because the police and the community of Lehi are extremely conservative, and they kind of forced them out. And although there was no legal ground for them to do so, the Attorney General said there's no way that we're going to arrest Cody Brown. He hasn't done anything other than just being a polygamist. He hasn't done anything wrong. The Browns have moved to Nevada so that they can live a more accepted lifestyle. But Cody Brown represents, like Brady Williams, as I was just indicating, he's also a progressive. Cody Brown represents one of the first depictions of a progressive plural family, a poly family that provides women with a lot of freedom of choice, a lot of advantage to use a network environment so that the women help each other achieve their dreams, including raising of the children, taking care of the household, and also, you know, striving for maybe careers. And
so let me ask you though, Janet, what drove them out? Was it the fact that they're polygamists, so you would think they would all, you know, be under one umbrella, but it was the fact that they were progressive and the women had, you know, some rights and, you know, weren't just breeders, you know, that is that why, you know, they were sort of run
no,
out of town?
No, I think that what you have to see is that the mainstream Mormon society doesn't want any kind of polygamy to be brought out in the open. And when Cody Brown decided to say yes to TLC's offer to parade his lifestyle, and also HBO parades the lifestyle of the polygamist, mainstream Mormon society is you know, their feathers are ruffled. Now, I understand this completely because I grew up in mainstream Mormon society. And for years, we were always taught that if you, you know, if you talk about polygamy, make sure you talk about it in a historical sense. That,
yeah.
you know, and I can do that easily because my great-great-grandfathers on three sides were all polygamous. And as long as you look at it historically, pre-1890s, before the manifesto, then it's okay. It's almost sacralized. But the fundamentalists, according to mainstream Mormon society, are breaking the law, breaking not only the civil law, but church law. And so they should be excommunicated. Well, the fundamentalists who still practice polygamy don't see it that way. They see that they're continuing the law. And
right.
so they've been continually ostracized, and many of them have gone into these far remote mountain or desert environment groups, and so they're outside the mainstream. But once these progressives start parading their lifestyles in front of the mainstream, then it becomes a threat. It becomes a threat to Mitt Romney, who tries twice to become president. It becomes
right.
a threat to, you know, and so mainstream Mormon communities put pressure on law enforcement to do something about it, and that's why Cody Brown had to
So let me just repeat what I think you just said. So it is against Mormon law now to practice polygamy, correct?
Right, since 1890.
Okay. Okay, I didn't realize that.
Most people don't know that.
yeah, I didn't realize that. I thought they just were all,
but
do it quietly.
Many who study polygamy, like myself, I label it Mormon polygamy or Mormon fundamentalism because the fact is that they're still adhering to the Joseph Smith Mormon doctrine. And so, therefore, they should also be called Mormon because they're of the Mormon culture. They're not Orthodox, but they are of the Mormon culture.
Well, you know,
I think it's the Joseph Smith ones that
most people probably hear about before, you know, the more progressive Mormon poly families hit television, because you end up with these poor women who are married, you know, these young women who are married off to these old men. They don't get an education. They're basically breeders, and I don't mean to be offensive, but when I saw that, I thought it was abusive and sickening.
That's the common reaction, and that's possibly, you know, a normal reaction to civil rights being violated, you know. I mean, and if that's all you're seeing, and that's what typically, since I have been studying this for 20 years, that's all the media has really cared about. That's all the media has ever really portrayed. And for 20 years, I've been trying to show that there's many faces of polygamy. You know, and so what most people are seeing are the Warren Jeffs groups or the Kingston groups, which has a lot of inbreeding and, you know, child bride marriages and all kinds of atrocities, such as Warren Jeffs himself being taped raping a 12-year-old wife in the temple. So, you know, obviously these are offensive, and this is what most of the people are associating with that Mormon polygamy. But let me tell you, after 20 years of studying this, I have to say there's so many different phases of polygamy. There's, the Williams family that I've been associated for years. It has a very progressive, very conscientious family life, and, you know, they moved from the Utah area to Washington, and they were given so much respect in their form of living that the husband and his two wives were actually given right to custody in a custody battle. The Fisher family of Utah was given the right to adopt, you know, and here is the Brady Williams family and the Cody Brown family that are on the cusp of actually changing the way that we legally perceive of the rights of poly families. And so I think that we need to acknowledge that many women are actually choosing this form of lifestyle.
Well,
and as feminists, we should, help them pave the way for this next marriage rights frontier.
Well, and I think what's important to maybe bring up, if listeners haven't thought about it, you know, if we talk about maybe matriarchal clans or matrilineal clans, you know, we're talking about, you know, potentially people from other cultures who, they didn't always have a husband, you know, and it was the brothers that helped raise the children of the women. And, you know, when the women would sort of band together and help each other raise the kids, and the assets passed from mother to daughter and things like that. So it makes sense. It feels like it's pragmatic in a way for women to, come together like this, like you described. You know, they can go to school, they have help with the children, you know, they have a built-in babysitter, a built-in support system. But I guess where I wonder about it is, how do they manage there not being jealousy among the wives, and who's going to get the husband, or are these more marriages of convenience than love arrangements, where, you know, jealousy might creep up amongst the women and then it gets a little ugly?
Well, polygamy is one of the most complex relationships that you can ever find. That's what attracted me to studying this. There's no way for me to easily answer that question. I can say that, yes, of course there's jealousies, but these jealousies can actually be overcome if you have an ideological template that says we need to get along if we're going to, you know, ascend, if we're going to actually improve and progress as a family. And so what you have with, say, let's just talk about the Brady Williams family. All of these women have already bought into that ideology. They believe that in the heavens there's going to be all kinds of rewards for them for their, the trials that they go through in this life. And they also have a history of watching their mothers and sisters and aunts get along well with each other. And so where you have a community of women who have a history of overcoming jealousy, it's much easier for you to do so.
Right.
But, of course, there's jealousies. One thing that creates fierce jealousies is an idiot husband. And
right.
If you have an idiot husband saying, I am God, I am, the God in the making, and you have to bow down to me, it's going to make it very difficult for the women to like each other, because he's creating competition among them for the right to be with him. But where you have a more relaxed, progressive husband, Cody Brown's kind of a media whore, so I don't know if I should talk about him, but I think Brady Williams is a good example of somebody who, has a more progressive idea about the strength of women, and that he fosters this feeling among his wives that they are all worth it, and that they're equally treated, and that they have equal value in his eyes. That diminishes the jealousy. And so
let me ask you, even if you have a good one like him, and the women are encouraged to be empowered, we're still probably talking about patriarchy. I mean, the men are still ruling the house, though, aren't they? Or are you saying that there can be egalitarianism in these poly families?
I think that polygamy is certainly patriarchal, even in the best of families, even in Brady Williams' families. So there's that, and we have to swallow that stone, and that's a hard one to swallow. But what you have to see is that there's also ironic ascendance for women. There's ironic joy and autonomy that most people don't ever associate with polygamy. That's my job, to indicate to you the various ironic ways that women find joy and satisfaction in this patriarchal lifestyle. For example, I've mentioned before the female network. That cannot be understated. You know, the idea that if you are overwhelmed as a young mother, your co-wife can help you out so that you can go and attend community college at the night school or whatever. Or that if you have a desire to get a career, it's your co-wives who are supporting you. Not your husband, it's your co-wives who are going to allow you that luxury. And there's so many examples of that. Economic interdependence, and emotional interdependence. if you, as a woman, are struggling, what better individual out there other than a woman who knows exactly what you're going through to support you, to give you help, a listening ear, even to the point where there has been sexual sharing, you know, that, although it's very rare. So the point is that there are benefits to live in a community of women. You have economic sharing, you have emotional and social and religious sharing, and in rare occasions, sexual comfort as well, especially during the long, prolonged absences of your husband.
So you're
so this
saying
is something that, you know,
you're saying lesbianism
is important. Yes.
Okay.
Although it's rare.
Okay.
You know, and this is just the beginning. You know, you also have respite from your husband. You know, in monogamy, many polygamous wives are telling me that they feel sorry for monogamous women because women in that situation are more readily under the thumb of their husbands.
Right.
That they don't have a lot of respite from him, that there's no break from that. And believe it or not, you know, we're still dealing with a traditional monogamous template that has not, that has never really been good for women in America. You know, you find that, you know, there's just as much, if not more, abuse in monogamous American marriage as there is in polygamous
marriage. Well, sure, without a doubt. But
there's that problem.
But okay, so, I'm, you know, you're convincing me that there's a lot for the women in this. But I guess I'm still curious about, you know, a little bit more curious about what their lives are really like. I mean, how do they decide who's going to be with the husband? These men that you sort of hold up as progressive examples, I mean, are they just sort of anomalies or there are a lot
no,
of progressive men like that?
And I wouldn't call them all progressives like the Brown and the Williams, but in the majority of cases that I have worked with that mostly come from the all-red groups and independents and the LeBarons as well, you have a template where women have choice of who they're going to marry above the age of 18. Again, this is the LeBaron, the all-red, formerly known as the Apostolic United Brethren, and independents. It's the Kingstons and the FLDS that do not have that kind of template for female choice. But in the all-reds, LeBarons, and the independents, you do. And in those, what I call more progressive venues, women, again, choose who they're going to marry, and they have a lot of choices. And they also, once they're married in a family, they set the sexual schedule and the budgeting of the household.
Can
the
they
man
get a divorce?
Does not.
Can they divorce?
And they can get released. In fact, in the all-red group, during the 3 to 5 years that I was associated in my field work with them, I accounted for a 30% divorce rate. Nothing
okay.
like the 44% that we have now, but in the mainstream, but 30%, which means that they acknowledge a woman's right to be released. They call it released, being released from a husband. And what they do is they practice hypergamy. Talk about
what is that?
Autonomy. And it's an anthropological term that means that you marry up. So you're released from your old husband, and you marry someone with greater priesthoods, greater financial status, or who's married to women that you like. So the all-red group allows for that hypergamy.
Well, that's interesting.
In fact,
I never heard that before.
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested
exactly.
about that. The idea that is it still something that is believed across the board, and this is maybe a little bit of a divergence, but you mentioned before that the women believe they get all these rewards when they, you know, when they pass on. I mean, do these men still believe they each get a planet, and the wives have to be invited by the husband to go to their planet in their next life?
The ideology, I mean, it would be like asking, you know, a practicing Catholic if they, you know, if they believe all of the, you know, intricacies of the doctrine. Some buy into it and some don't. But the ideology is, yes, that eventually men and their wives will be able to ascend to the thrones, being gods and goddesses of their own world. And so polygamy continues on afterwards, which means that, yes, the man will have more control. He may actually have more than one world. If he's got five wives, that means he's got five worlds. Do they literally plan that out meticulously? I don't know. And some no longer even believe that. Brady Williams, for example, no longer buys into that form of the doctrine. And in fact, his family is moving towards Buddhism. So, but yes,
wow.
If you are a strict fundamentalist, and actually mainstream Mormons believe this as well, that eventually you will evolve to become gods and goddesses of your own world.
Very interesting. Well, and it's interesting that you say gods and goddesses, because, you know, when I had a Mormon, a young woman on the show, she wanted to talk to me about Mormonism. She felt like she wanted to try to, you know, give a better, a twist on it. And one of the things I asked her was, well, you know, because she was trying to, I asked her, I said, well, if there isn't, you know, if things are really going well for women in Mormonism, and, you know, you've cited a lot of ways that, you know, that they can enjoy this, but do you ever see it where the woman can have more husbands, or is it only the other way around?
No, you'll never see that, and that's a problem. That's possibly one reason why I'm not active. You know, I mean, whether you're talking about fundamentalist Mormonism or mainstream Mormonism, why isn't it that the women can, why can't they hold the priesthood? Why can't women, you know, have multiple husbands? Why can't gays and lesbians find a home within Mormonism? So these are some of the reasons why I'm on the fringe, you know, hoping for
right.
that one day when things will change. In fact, I've recently finished this novel that's both historical and futuristic, where one day women do get the priesthood and that gays and lesbians have a home in the mainstream church. You know, that's my fantasy. So, yeah, obviously
yeah.
that hasn't come yet, and it may not. I don't know.
The other thing, too,
if we're really talking about relative freedom for women, you know, Mormonism, there's variable faces of Mormons. There's liberal Mormons like myself. But, you know, to hope that the mainstream church will ever give the priesthood to women, I don't know.
Well, and
that.
The other thing, too, which I find a little bit confusing, is they talk about within Mormonism that there is a feminine face of God, the Great Mother or something. I may be
yes,
wrong about the
definitely.
Title. But, you
oh,
know,
yes,
in speaking to this other young woman, you know, she more or less said, you know, she can't recall that she is on the same level as God, and she's really rarely talked about. Is that true? Has that been your experience?
Yeah, that is a problem. And, you know, it's in our doctrine. It is written in, you know, the Mormon doctrine. It's written in beautiful evidence of it in our hymns, written by Eliza R. Snow. I've named my daughter after her, Liza. And it's all about, you know, there is a mother there. And it's not just a father. How could a father procreate without the mother? And so
mm-hmm.
there is a heavenly mother. But once you start, like I did, and some of my liberal Mormon friends, start praying to the mother in public, you know, that's poo-hooed on. And so I think that what we're seeing is, you have fringe elements of that alive in Mormonism, but for the mainstream group to embrace that, you know, you've got to have a different leadership. You've got to have a female leadership, and certainly
right.
then you'll see more and more women praying to God the Mother, vocally, publicly.
That's frowned upon by the church hierarchy.
Right. It may. I don't know why, because it's in the doctrine. I think, well, because the
yeah,
mainstream church is patriarchal. It's patriarchal.
Right.
So one
well,
day maybe things will change. And what's remarkable is one of my first experiences in polygamy, of all places, was where I heard some women praying to the mother and using the mother's blessing, which said that they had the priesthood, just as Emma Smith, Joe Smith's first wife, had the priesthood. They had the priesthood too, and they were going to use the Melchizedek priesthood to bless their children. Very radical. And where was I? I was in a fundamentalist polygamous group at the time. So I was shocked, and that really turned my gaze to look at the variability in polygamy. that it's not uniformly abusive, you know, and that it's not polygamy per se that's causing all these abuses. And so we have to look elsewhere.
Yeah, because just the term feminist polygamy, it sounds like those are two, two opposites.
Right, like an not an oxymoron, but an oxymoron. Yeah, it sounds like it's
very good,
to be
very
said
good.
In the same sentence. And I've been surprised every time I find pockets of feminism in the most interesting of places. But, you know, you can find that also in the Middle East. You know, if we're looking at the rigid patriarchal
group, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
If
we move away from Mormons, what about the polygamy with Muslims or other groups? Are you finding this sort of same attitude, or is it sort of a different flavor? And I also want you to talk a little bit about the
polyandry. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, first, when you're looking at what we call polygyny, polygamy is the umbrella term. Polygamy, many gamies, is many women, or many marriages, many matings. And so when you're talking about that as an umbrella term, it's close to polygyny, which is many, one man having many wives. Polyandry is one woman having many husbands. So that's just some terminology for you. Now, in the world, you know, in the Middle East, many anthropologists have studied the huge variability in polygamy in all over, you know, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And, of course, there are some extremely violent and hard cases for women in many contexts. Of course, in Afghanistan, one of the harshest. In northern Africa, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. But occasionally, in Iran, is one of those that one colleague of mine had, Dr. Friedel, lived in Iran, and she found that polygamy, when regulated, actually provides enormous power for women. In fact, she related it to South African polygamy, which has not only legalized it, but has required the man to prove that he has economic and emotional ability to care for his wives equally before granted a civil right to marry. And I'm thinking that maybe we can learn something from South Africa, because that is both empowering to the men and the women, and
right,
therefore it would allow regulation of the practice so that there would be fewer abuses.
Right.
Now, you asked about polyandry, and I'm sorry to say that polyandry is very rare.
I was about to say, you know, most women don't have the financial wherewithal, if for no other reason,
right,
I think, to have more than one husband.
Whereas there's 85 different cultures in the world that condone polygamy or polygyny, there's only less than 4% of the world's cultures that allow for polyandry. And
but
this
talk
is only
about
where
those,
formally
even
in a marriage.
Hmm?
Right. So where you find it's formal marriage of one woman to many men, it's in the form of fraternal polyandry. And this is mostly in the Himalayas, in Tibet, in Nepal, where you have very strict rules of inheritance. And in those regions, you can imagine how difficult it is to farm. And so the families have these terraced farms that are very small areas of gardens and areas for grazing, that if you had a polygamous situation, you would have so many offspring that you couldn't possibly provide for all of them in inheritance. And so what you've got to do is figure out a way to reduce the number of children. What better way than have one woman, one womb, you see, with four or five different brothers, and so that she can't possibly have any more children than, say, the, you know, and in Tibet and Nepal, it's on average 3 to 5 children per woman. And
so when
what
a woman does have a child in polyandry, Janet, do they know or care who is the father?
No, they don't care.
Okay.
They don't care, and they do not know. And the brothers have become accustomed to sharing. Let me say this again. Men in Nepal are accustomed to sharing with each other. They have very reduced male-male competition, very opposite of what you'd see in most of the world. And so these very dynamic fathers are willing to give up their role as genitors and collectively don the role of pater and help in raising their wives' children, regardless of who was the father. Now,
you said this is fraternal polyandry. Is there non-fraternal polyandry?
It's rare. You have to have some kind of link between the men for them to agree to do this.
Right.
And unless, you know, they're brothers, why would they, or cousins, why would they do that? And so
right.
It's really rare. And the only problem is, and you'd think that this is a great chance for women to finally be able to say, okay, I'm, you know, I have autonomy and I have the ability to sleep with this man, and this man, and this man. And it should be empowering. But in these cases, these women are overworked and they are, in many cases, overwhelmed. And so they have a psychological disease called dolo dukkha, where the woman pretends to be pregnant because only then can she be free from work.
Wow.
Because otherwise she has to not only sexually service her 4 to 5 husbands, you know, in their turn, but she has to help provide food for them, help to raise the children, you know, and they're helping too. There's overlapping of tasks, but she has more work than any other individual within the household.
Polygamy is looking better.
Yeah, I think so. If you've got all these women
around
you, polygamy,
in the polyandry,
it might be easier.
In the polyandry, then, who's the dominant one? Is it the man, or is it, you know, is it equal, or how does that usually work? Because otherwise,
well,
she's just their
oldest
she's
brother.
Their sex slave, you know.
It's the oldest brother.
The oldest
the
brother.
This is a patrilineage, and so there is slightly more power to the you know, oldest brother because that's actually his home. It's patrilocal, patrilineal. So the women
well,
come
curious,
in from other areas.
What happens if she has a daughter? What then happens to the daughter?
Well,
is the daughter
the
then thrown
in
into this mess?
No, not necessarily. And this is why I'm saying partial power. It's not as strict as you'd find in patrilineal families in the Middle East, for example. There's more power of choice for the women, so she has a daughter. That daughter can choose to go into a monastery to be a non-sexual but free and empowering woman, or they can go into work. They don't have to go into this life of family and marriage. They can, you know, and if a woman wants to go into a career, she can have lovers. But if they decide to marry in a traditional way, have to marry many brothers. And so that's the choice they make.
The mother's partners, those men don't have any sexual claim on the daughter.
What? You mean? No, they cannot claim to be her father. They're collectively her father. And she
yes,
has
they're collectively her father, but
leave the
there's
family
no sexual
or
relationship.
Stay in the lifestyle she wants. But if she does stay in the lifestyle, she will be moving from her mother and father's home to another patrilineage.
Okay.
So typically the daughters leave. Yeah,
okay.
And that's called patrilocality, where the women marry out of the system. And that happens in a lot of areas in the world.
These cultures that still have some form of matrilineal descent, I think it, I want to say, is it the Navajo and I
yeah,
think there's some
the
places
Hopi,
in China.
The Navajo, the Iroquois.
Are these women with one man or those women with, you know, fraternal polyandry or anything like that?
No, it's typically serial monogamy, or
okay.
A new term that I have called loose polygyandry, where you know, among the Navajo, for example, the women are the ones who own the homes, and you trace your descent through the female line, which is patrilineality. But if a woman is dissatisfied with her husband for any reason, traditionally she just puts his materials, clothes, whatnot, tools outside the hogan, and that's officially a sign of divorce.
Okay,
you
so
know,
let me
and
ask
so then
you
she
about that,
moves
though,
on to the next to the next husband, which may be loosely called polyandry. But he has also the right to a divorce as well. So, you know, I mean, it's in a way, it's monogamy for a time until we find you find who you really want to be with.
So
and that,
in
and
that
that's
case,
not so unheard of in Native traditional Native American societies.
So in that
poly lifestyles like that.
So in that case, where the Navajo woman, you know, has those rights, you know, we always hear about there's such horrible domestic abuse to Native American women. Are the Navajo women excluded from that since it's, you know, the assets are passed from mother to daughter and she can just put his stuff outside the hogan and be done with him if he beats her up?
Oh, wait, I think we need to step back make sure that you're recognizing that this is traditional, what I'm talking about. You know, traditionally, before the reservation, prior to reservation, women were treated ubiquitously well in most Native American society. But after the reservation, the Native men took on the worst characterizations of their conquerors, the white men, and they started beating their women, treating their women poorly, keeping the resources from the women, denying them access to inheritance, et cetera, et cetera, almost copying a European schema. So you're right. In this day and age, post-reservation, some of the worst abuses are found against Native women. And that's one of the reasons why the Violence Against Women Act was enacted, to make sure that even in sovereign nations, women would be protected from their husbands. But so I can't say that even now, you know, with the Navajo, there's not more abuse among the Navajo than there is any other group. Even matrilineal groups have abuses against women, unfortunately, in the post-reservation system.
Well, but
and
I guess my question was, if they're the ones with the assets and they're the ones that can put his stuff outside the door, then I guess I was assuming, you know, and of course that's a bad thing to do, but I was assuming that there might be less domestic abuse in, you know, these more matrilineal Native American groups, but maybe not.
Right. I can't answer that. I would assume that that gives them an edge. But with alcohol and, you know, other issues like unemployment, you know, there's still some abuse.
Well, tell us about this. When I read in your bio about your theory explaining the role of the desert environment that develops and maintains the patriarchal ideology. What was that about?
Well, now, it's not always the case, because you can see the exceptions of traditional Hopi and Navajo and Zuni and Tiwa, which were very much matrilineal groups, and they lived in the desert. But if you look at these numbers, they're very small. Most desert, grassland, pastoral cultures have a high degree of patriarchy. The Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the North African and East African pastoral societies, some of the most rigid patriarchal societies on the face of the earth. So what I did is I wanted to test this out in Chihuahua, which is a real formidable desert. And so I took some students and I went down and lived with some groups down there. And many of the groups that I lived with were Anglo communalists, the Mennonites, strict Mormon fundamentalists that don't practice polygamy and Mormon fundamentalists that do practice polygamy. And I thought I'd try to figure out if they also were like many of the Saudi Arabian Bedouins that used patriarchy as a form of keeping women in control. And they did. And so what you see is more of what we call the type of polygyny that is giving rise to male control of females as chattels, as resources, occurs in desert environments than in any other kind of environment. And one of the
but
reasons
is there a
is
reason
that you,
for it?
Yes, the reason is that in the desert, especially where you don't have any driver's license for women and that they have no access to money or vehicles, they are experiencing circumscriptive pressures. Circumscription is not circumcision. That's another form of oppression. But circumscription is where you keep women in the system geographically. They have geographic and social barriers to leave that system. And one of the things that was used in the polygamist context was the threat of losing one's salvation if you absconded or escaped with your children and left the polygamous commune. You would face severe salvation deprivation. You'd be you'd risk your salvation in the next life if you tried to do that. And then there's also the issue of having no money. How are you going to go up into the United States with no money, with five kids? You know, so
right.
What desert does is it keeps the women there, just as it did with, the peasants of the Egyptian Empire or the Semites in the Sumerian Empire. You keep individuals in a geographically isolated place because they don't want to risk starvation on the outside.
Right.
And so.
Right, right.
I argue that the desert promotes female circumscription, therefore it promotes more rigid patriarchy.
Well, and you said circumcision, and I was actually had in the back of my mind to ask you about female genital mutilation. Is any of that going on in any of these groups? And does it have anything to do with the polygamy?
No, not at all.
Or, okay.
Not in North American, and not in Middle Eastern, but where you have a history of tribal bride's wealth and tribal circumcision in East Africa, it's very much still going on. So it's not so much identified with Islam as it is identified with an East African pastoral cultural template to make sure that the women are controlled reproductively. And so, you know, if you have a pharaonic circumcision, that is, you not only cut off the clitoris, but you stitch up the labia in order to make sure that this young woman is not going to be penetrated or not going to be affiliated sexually with anybody before her bride wealth comes in. And so it's a way for the father of the daughter to make sure that he gets the bride wealth payment, and afterward for the husband to know that his wife or wives are not cheating on him. So it's pretty harsh.
I had someone on the show from Amnesty International, and and they mentioned that this FGM, it isn't just in Africa, that it's in, you know, Muslim countries and Saudi Arabia and places like that as well. Has that been changing, or is that just not an area you looked into as much?
I would say that because Islam is a global religion, that many of the North and East African tribes, which experienced this pre-Islam, migrated with this tradition into Islamic countries. But Islam does not mandate it. It has it's very little to do with the Quran, you see. So the only thing that the Quran says about, you know, treating women is that there's a lot of actually beneficial things about that, you know, providing equal money to each wife, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as the FGM, that is not an Islamic doctrine at all. And so what I'm saying is that though you may see it in Saudi Arabia, you may see it in North Africa, or even parts of Europe and the United States, it comes from a uniquely tribal heritage from East Africa and North Africa.
I understand now.
See what I'm trying to say?
It's not an Islamic.
Origin is not from Islam.
Yeah, it's not an Islamic practice. It's more
right.
of a blend of Islam with something else, some sort of tribal, an indigenous tribal thing that goes along
exactly.
with it. You know, like
in
a
fact,
sort of
Islam,
syncretized tradition or belief system or something like that.
Many of the imams who were trying to manage health concerns suggested to steer clear of the pharaonic circumcision and adapt a more well, just say the clitorectomy. So they were trying to improve on the model for women, although that's not that much of an improvement, a clitorectomy.
Right,
Not that great.
bad or worse. Janet, we're starting to, we have probably about 5 or so minutes left, and we've covered a lot of ground, but is there anything we haven't talked about that you wanted to make sure to share with listeners?
Well, I really wanted to, just in closing, reiterate that maybe it's time that we extend some of the civil rights feminist progress that we're making and extend that, to the lives of poly families, especially those women who live in these progressive contexts where they really have chosen this form of marriage. You know, and I really adopt the ACLU's concept that if we're looking at the First Amendment and due process of the 14th Amendment, that should allow us to define the contours of our sexuality and express our religious beliefs freely, as long as we don't do harm to others. You know, and this is a very strong statement, no harm to others. And so
but
if we have evidence...
But that's a slippery slope, you know, because I bet Joseph Smith, you couldn't get him to admit that he's doing harm to those child brides. He'd say he was doing them a favor.
Well, then in that case, that would be harm-based, wouldn't it? So if we're talking, let's look at the contemporary case. If we're talking about Warren Jeffs or any of those like the Kingstons who typically contract these child brides, well, that would be not only against the law in terms of, that you cannot marry anyone who's 14, but that would be an abuse. So what I'm saying is that you have the right between two consensual adults in terms of defining your sexuality and your marital form, as long as there are no abuses. So
right.
The abuses that would be absent from that are those
right.
that are absent from the Brady Williams family, from the Cody Brown family. Those
right.
families do not have underage brides. All wives were consensually contracted to marry their men. There is no physical abuse, no sexual abuse. There's no money laundering. There's no illegal arms. You know, these are typically things that are often associated with poly families, but many, 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 many families who practice polygamy do not have any of these abuses. And
well,
in
I always
fact,
wonder how they afforded all of those kids, you know. I mean, they seem like they must make a lot of money that they can afford all of these wives and children.
The trick is that you have three wives who are working as well as perhaps the husband. So in Brady Williams' case, he's a construction worker, so he built his homes. And so there's no cost there. And then three
yeah.
of his wives work outside the home. So you've
right.
got four income, yeah. five adults, and, yes, 20 children.
20 children.
So you've got to have about five adults working, four adults, excuse me.
You know, I can agree with what you're saying as long as it's consenting adults, but what about the bubble factor? And by that I mean, you know, if a young woman grows up this way and she sees her mother or her aunts growing up this way and maybe they don't know anybody who lives any differently, I don't know, you know, maybe this just happens every place anyway. I mean, I grew up in the bubble of the South, you know, in the Bible Belt bubble.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I guess we're all in our bubble, but I guess I'm thinking to myself, can a young woman really make an informed choice if she, you know, if everybody around her has always lived this way, if maybe she doesn't, you know,
right.
grow up and go to college.
To a great extent, like you said, that we are all brainwashed to live, you know, I've been brainwashed to believe that the Democratic Party is the best party in the universe because my dad told me that and showed
right.
me how it made sense, right? Okay, so we're all brainwashed. The
right.
point is that if you are a polygamist family and you're living in a quasi-mainstream environment, like many of these independents and the all-reds and the LeBarons I was telling you about do, then at least your children have an opportunity to see how other children live, how
yeah.
other people are living. And then you can make your choice if that program allows you choice. The danger are the remote groups that practice a more rigid form of dominant patriarchal control over their women who utilize, you know, the child bride program, they are more likely to experience these alleged harms of polygamy than any other. And with that, I agree with you.
So is the, or, you know, if someone encounters people like this, is there anything they can do to help these women, or do they just look the other way, or... I'm just curious if you
have
any thoughts on that.
There are outlets from women, established by women who have actually left the more rigid groups. You know, Carolyn Jessup, for example, various other voices for polygamy. You know, there's these groups that provide outlets for women, and you can find them on the internet, and you can, you know, actually email and say, "Will you pick me up?" And this is happening a lot with the FLDS. There's a lot of attrition. Fallout, if you will, much more than ever before, because women are no longer satisfied with that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah,
and
I've interviewed women that are taking the quiverful movement. You know, and yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's, you know.
But one thing that you're forgetting about is men, and that is that how many men might be doing poorly in such a group. Especially a group like FLDS, where, what was it, about 400 men within 1 year were ostracized and kicked out of the group and left homeless because
why was that?
They were listening to rock and roll. Well, the true reason was he was practicing elite polygyny, which is he wanted more wives, more control over the resources. And if you have too many men, it doesn't work, so you've got to kick them out.
Thin the herd. Thin out the competition.
Exactly. So we really need to have another talk show on how it may be harmful to young men.
Absolutely. I wish we had gotten to that sooner, but alas, there is no time now. But Janet, thank you so much. I'm so glad you came back, and my apologies again for the, you know, the blog talk difficulties, you know, a while back when we didn't get you on the air. But it was a lot of fun, and I think you've, you know, really raised our awareness about all of this. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. Take care.
Okay, good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, and I see my next guest is there on the switchboard, and I am going to get to Sula in just one moment, but first I have to do a little bit of business.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected. They were together. That there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was some of the dialogue from the trailer, Dancing with Gaia. It's a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, the return of the goddess as Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connection between these important topics. And the DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini-book that expands on the material in the film. You can get it at dancingwithgaia.com, and it's only $20. And with the holidays upon us, it might be something you'd like to think about for your own library or for some of your friends. Next up, I would like to turn my attention to our next guest, award-winning French-Lebanese writer, producer, director Sula Saad. She's going to discuss her project Feminitude and the Unheard Feminine in the Middle East, which is the first of 8 films. So let me unmute her and say hello. Hi, Sula.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being
with
me.
Sorry?
I said thank you so much for being with me tonight. I want to tell listeners a little bit about you, and then we'll jump in and talk about your films, okay?
Sure.
So Sula, and pronounce your last name for me. Is it Saad?
Yes, Saad.
Okay. Sula Saad is, like I said before, an award-winning French-Lebanese writer, producer, director, whose images and music blends time and genre. Founder of Nota Bene Production to produce conscious educational entertainment. She's passionate about travel, world cultures, world music, and she's been documenting first in writing every place she traveled to since an early age. Escaping the several conflicts that raged in Lebanon, where she grew up. Her forced exiles led her to Cyprus, Greece, Italy, Spain, Switzerland, England, and France, recording her experiences in a travel journal, taking pictures and recording the songs discovered in her travels. Very interesting woman. She was around filmmakers that inspired her to express all the stories in her. And we're going to talk about her new projects right now. So, Sula, as I said, welcome to the show. When I saw that you were over at Lee and Carla's at Olander, I was so sorry I didn't get to see the screening of your film, but I'm glad to be talking to you now.
I am also delighted, Karen, to be on your show and to be discussing the feminine. That's been a long inspiration, and I've been actually since the year 2000 very much wanting to capture and record what the sounds of that new millennium that I sensed was coming with more of a feminine touch.
Right.
Would compel women to say more out loud. And so I've been on this adventure for almost 13 years now and 8 more to go, capturing and amplifying, inspiring women voices with that, you know, dream to be able to have at least a sample of what the collective feminine voice would sound like in the beginning of this millennium with all the changes that we are witnessing.
Well, let me ask you, Sula, because we mentioned when we spoke briefly that you picked up my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. What did
yes.
you think about that? Growing
love...
up, were you familiar with the goddess in the Middle East?
Yes. I have to say that in a very interesting, strange way, it's through an American woman, another American woman, Lane Redman, that you may know.
Ah, Lane. She's been here on the show often.
Ah, wonderful. And her book and the fact that she inspired me and she's one of the American women that I interviewed brought my attention through her book on all, When the Drummers Were Women.
Yeah.
And I think she's actually editing soon a new version of the book and updating it with, you know, recent finds. She got my attention on the fact that the frame drum, which is really the first instrument associated with women in a lot of sculptures and that we can still see in the Middle East and around the Mediterranean, that were temples and sites where there were many rituals to the goddess. And when I picked up Lane's book, a little bit like yours, I always open a book randomly, and in both cases I opened it on sacred sites in Lebanon, where I was heading. So it just seemed amazing, and it seemed like a sign and an invitation to actually go visit
the site. So that's how it started. It's, the serendipity
yes.
is always very magical, it seems,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
So Sula, when you talk about so this project you have coming up, your global project, Feminitude, is that the same thing as the Unheard Feminine Voice, or is it two separate projects?
No, actually, Feminitude is like the umbrella mother project for 8 films that will be different expressions of the feminine within subcultures. So I started with the Unheard Feminine Voice of the Middle East because, one, I happen to be from there. Second, doing documentaries there recently, I realized that there is some sort of a contrast between, you know, the power of the women that I meet and the image that I see of the Middle East, and some sort of questions started really emerging in me. How come we never hear this voice? How come I never, you know, in the media or anywhere else really see it? And I felt compelled, since I am often between this world and the ancient world, to compile interesting women voices from the Middle East, because I feel that that's a dimension of the Middle East we are completely missing on in the West. Or correct me, Karen.
Well, no. I think you're absolutely right. There's only been little glimmers. I mean, like, for instance, recently that young girl who was attacked by the, I think, the Taliban for wanting to go to school, and she became this, you know, this global, you know, this global figure. And I heard, and I don't know if it's accurate, but the Egypt Spring, that that was started by a woman in her living room. You know, and there were a lot of women on the front lines with the Egypt Spring, you know, risking rape and, you know, abuse by the police and being beat up. And so the women are there.
Yes, that brings us actually to the core of my subject, because I have had to reschedule my filming in Egypt because of these circumstances. When I heard that within the time frame I was scheduled to go, that within 3 days, you know, more than 90 women were harassed sexually. I didn't feel it was a proper time to go. And yet, of course, it is still precious to me and subject myself as a woman to this happening, you know, on the ground.
Yes, too dangerous.
It's precious to me, you know, to get these women's voice. And I am appalled that they have to be subjected to that. I can choose to go or not to go. But, you know, they're, as soon as they're out in the street in Egypt, they had been targeted and intimidated through sexual harassment. And I find that not only unacceptable, but really, especially after how we saw women up front and really present in all the protests and the liberation movement, it seemed quite unfair.
Right. Well, and just recently in the news, I think it was in Saudi Arabia, they were saying that women couldn't drive because it would affect their uterus and they wouldn't be able to bear children. I mean, the absurd things these men will do to keep their boot on the neck of women is just incredible. But I guess what I wonder, though, Sula, and I always wonder, you know, just like here in the United States, you know, we have conservative sections of the country where we have women that work with the patriarchy to keep other women down. Do you find that it's the very same thing in the Middle East?
Yes. I am very sad to say, Karen, that this is true everywhere, and that as I've been researching, you know, the feminine and its different expressions, and I am sad to report that I do feel that women are not the best ally to feminitude or to womanhood or to each other. And, and often, you know, it's a learned programming that we are almost unconsciously being part of and repeating without really measuring the consequences on ourselves, our sisters, and even more so, I would say, our daughters and, you know, the upcoming generation. I don't know if you heard in the last few weeks as well about these two girls from Yemen, one 8-year-old that died on what they call her honeymoon. I'm sorry, at 8-year-old, it's no honeymoon. This is like a pedophile act. And if the government wants, you know, to back up that and give it other name, then we really have to become very cautious about the language. And stop things before they are transvestite like that. I feel that it is...
Well, yeah, if the government backs up something like that, then the government's got a problem. You know, I mean, that, like you said, that's child abuse.
Yes, and, you know, I mean, with international laws and different government, you can put pressure on the government to make sure that they are respectful of international laws before they are part of United Nations and other international organizations that they are eager to be part of. So I think here we have really a lever and a way to put pressure and make these things unacceptable, or at least, you know, state certain values that have to be respected globally and internationally. If we don't have such an agreement, then it becomes much more difficult to, even for instance, for organizations like the UN for Women to really take actions if we don't have some sort of global agreement on what's acceptable and what's not.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's really hard to justify. I'm sorry, you know.
Yeah.
It, like you said, it's just a perversion. It's pedophilia. You know, if they want to call it marriage.
Legalized, yes.
Yeah. I mean, who are they kidding, you know?
Yes. And now, you know, a few weeks later, there's an 11-year-old who's running away from her home, and she's lucky to have an uncle who doesn't seem aligned with the rest of her family that she can flee to because she's been promised to marry to a 41-year-old she doesn't know. And this is selling, you know. This is not marrying. I'm sorry.
Right.
I feel that an 11-year-old with a 41-year-old seems like, if it was by choice and she was, you know, over 18, it's another story altogether. But at 11?
Yeah. Yeah, it's that's just unconscionable. It's unconscionable. And you know, and I don't know, do the maybe the mothers don't have a voice in this, or maybe they're like the women we've talked about. I mean, Phyllis Chesler, she's a famous feminist who wrote a book about women's inhumanity to women. So we know women can be cruel to each other. I mean, on my last guest, we were talking about female genital mutilation. Oftentimes it's the mother or the aunt or the grandmother that takes their the young girl and subjects her to this brutality.
I've also, you know, as I've been actually simultaneously with the Middle Eastern women, I've been developing the African women voices because, as I may have mentioned to you, I'm trying to go to every subculture and find what are women struggling with specifically in that subculture. And in Africa, obviously, all the women are struggling with the threats of being, you know, of having to go through genital mutilation, which is another completely unacceptable thing in our time and age. And there was a law. I'm very happy to see it progress a little bit, although it may not, you know, be applied as fast as we wish. But there was an international law a year or two ago that Amnesty International worked for that makes it illegal, really, today, genital mutilation, even if some governments choose to follow tradition rather than law. It is today considered illegal internationally.
Well, that's good to hear. So, Sula, when you talk to all of these women, is there a common thread that you hear, or are these women's voices, you know, what they're talking about, is it as diverse as the women themselves in the countries they're from?
Yes, I think they are. I think they are because I covered, you know, also a very wide array. And it's not, you know, I'm not restricted to an age group or a social class. I'm really trying to see if that attitude toward women, because really feminitude for me is about a feminine attitude, you know, is about a feminine embracing attitude, is about a win-win attitude, because we women don't enter necessarily a competition naturally, but it's a learned thing. So there is, of course, as many diverse stories as there are women, and there are also common denominators. And through, you know, subcultures, like in Africa, genital mutilation is one. In most of the Middle East, women are not able to pass on their nationality papers to their children and are very discriminated in so many ways. There are definitely common denominators, but what I find amazing is that women in all these diverse and different subcultures are all, at the end of the day, limited by much more than the man gender. And I'm not, you know, against in any way. I'm trying to find a way, actually, for the feminine to strive with the masculine.
Right,
There's
right.
just got to be more space for that.
So would it be accurate to say at the root of a lot of these, the common denominator of most women's suffering is religion?
Religion is definitely a big part, because it comes with so much, and each one, you know, of the religion, there's no exception, has really put a woman in a completely submissive role. And it's a pity, and again, through even, you know, Lane Redman, I discovered how present women were in the spiritual rituals and playing the frame drum and being the priestesses. And that whole role was, like, really withdrawn. And each one of the religions did that, you know, in a way you don't see really prominent priests in Christianity, Islam, or Judaism.
No, it's the patriarchy of the Abrahamic religions that,
yes,
squashed woman. And we say, you know, women got the short end of the stick, so to speak, when patriarchy got rid of goddess. And I guess I wonder, quietly underground, do any of these women know about goddess or know about the divine feminine archetypes, or they just all sort of live in this patriarchal Abrahamic religious bubble?
Yes, I think they are. I think, you know, some have totally the intuitive sensitivity. And when I reconnect with friends and old friends, and I feel that each was aware of something, you know, maybe one thing. Like, for instance, one person may be aware of the Lady of Byblos, but not much more about that. But I cannot say that I felt there was a real consciousness of the presence of the goddess. And even temples that I've been to, such as the Venus Temple in Baalbek, which is one of the most beautiful and massive Roman temple in the Lebanese mountains, doesn't include the Venus Temple in the regular touristic visits of the ruins.
Well, I'm going to have to Google it and try to see a picture of it. So it's the Venus Temple.
Same for same for Byblos, and both you mentioned in your book, and both are sites and ruins that I have visited. But again, the temples, goddesses are never part of the circuit. So now, because the same thing happened in South America when I was lost there, I start to be intrigued. Is there an intention to keep these temples outside the circuit?
I think so.
I have to jump to that conclusion. I don't like to generalize, but I've seen it now in many places, and I kind of get the sense that that's not something that they want to talk about, show, highlight, and it's obviously put aside. I mean, it hasn't even been restored properly. Not that they're restoring, you know, the other temples, but at least they're maintaining them. Since
right.
They use them as a setup for music festivals and
Tell you, when I was in Malta, you know, you see those figurines of the goddesses there, you know, the delicate little ankles and the dresses, and you know, you don't have the upper part of the body, but you have, like, maybe from the waist down, and they're obviously wearing a dress, and they have these delicate little ankles and feet. And when we were there, because Malta is a very Christian patriarchal place, they would tell the tourists that these were sumo wrestlers. You know, they couldn't even, you know, they're staring a feminine, you know, a feminine image is staring them in the face, and they make an absurd statement like these are sumo wrestlers, you know. I think it is a deliberate attempt to keep the patriarchy in power. And because, you know, there are those of us that believe that, you know, goddess and the divine feminine, you know, really was a hard mistress to dethrone, and it took a lot to get rid of goddess. And you know, they never want they don't want that partnership between goddess and god, because then, you know, women would start to realize that the divine is also in their image too, and heaven forbid that women would want equality in partnership. That would unravel the fabric of society, you know. They wouldn't maybe continue to be agreeable to be slaves and cheap labor and all the rest.
Well, you know, but to that, what I would answer, Karen, is a saying from Boutros Ghali, who used to be head of the UN maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he said something that really stayed with me. He said that humanity was a bird with two wings, and one of the wing is female, and the other is male. And you know that for humanity to be able to really soar and fly, the two wings has to be equally strong. And
he stole that from Rumi. He stole that from
possible.
Rumi.
I love that several men agree on this.
Yes.
That, you know, our priority as men and women should be focused really on strengthening the feminine wing, because otherwise humanity will not be able to fly. And men and women really have the interest to see that balance in them, because I'm yes, interviewing and amplifying women voices, but the feminine is present in men and women. And as a matter of fact, if I'm even able to do this work, is because I've had a Middle Eastern father so much in touch with his feminine.
Right.
And,
right,
you know, who wanted so much to contribute to that, educating, empowering, and liberating the feminine. Because
absolutely,
at the end of the day, you know, since we are living in a patriarchal society, and even more so in the Middle East, it really depends on your immediate environment whether it will allow you, you know, that or not. So
yeah, because look, you had a father who believed, you know, he sort of went against the system, and you know, and here you are, and you know, an educated, aware woman from the Middle East. There was just an article about another filmmaker in Saudi Arabia, a woman filmmaker in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, she's on my wish list for the Middle Eastern Women Voices, because that's exactly, you know, the voices I'm trying to amplify, is women that step out of the boxes that are imposed by, be it society, family, the environment, religion. There are very many layers
of
limitations imposed
on
us.
Well, I would recommend, if you haven't heard about it yet, you might get some leads on some other voices. There's a documentary that's just started making the rounds the last few months called Femme, Women Healing the World.
Oh, and yes, I actually know the filmmaker, and I've seen it.
Yes, I'm actually in it, I am proud to say, along with some of my mentors. And yes, Emmanuel Etier, he's wonderful. He's the perfect example of the guy of the future. He's like one of these Renaissance men who totally gets it, you know. And,
yes, absolutely. And I have to say that I had a very exquisite lunch with Emmanuel and a common producer friend, Simon Ederi, who both were telling me, and it was really so pleasant to my ears, Karen, to hear two men saying, we don't even know how you can stand us, how you're actually even responding in a nice, genuine, feminine way after all that we have done to you.
Right. Well,
and you know, there's healing in that too, because to be able to forget and forgive and turn
on
that
both sides.
Maybe we need to have some acknowledgement.
Yes. Well, and you know, honestly, I'm so glad you said that. You know, that's very touching. You know, to know that some men realize that we ought to be really angry. You know, we ought to be really angry instead of these men like Rush Limbaugh, who, when women want equality and just don't want some men telling them what to do with their body or their reproductive health, he wants to call us feminazis, you know. So you have the other extreme of, you know, these crazy oppressive men that still want to tell women to put an aspirin between their knees. You know, for birth
control. You know, the thing is that every level where they can feel that they can take advantage of the law, and they've done it. I mean, I can tell you stories of the women I interviewed, and each, you know, had to really pay a high price for that. One, for example, being deprived of her children for 20 years because the law can back up man that far.
Right.
And, you know, in other case, a woman that finds herself with no papers whatsoever because her mother cannot give her her nationality. And
now, what's that about? Explain that. I don't know what that means.
That is true in most Arabic countries, that actually the woman has no rights to pass on paper, nationality, identity papers to her children. I know, it seems unbelievable. I'm glad you don't know about it, Karen, because what that means, for instance, is if I was married to an Italian, French, or an American man, my children could not be Lebanese, the Lebanese woman. And that's true in almost every other Arab country. I think Tunisia and Egypt had changed that recently. And
so
I'm not sure where it
stands. So
you're
saying that the child takes on the heritage of the father? Is that what you mean? Rather than the mother?
Yes. But what I'm saying is even, you know, more terrible, because even if there isn't a father figure, the mother cannot really pass or claim to pass on her, you know, title, paper to her child. And therefore, that can create a big problem with children that find themselves paperless.
Wow.
And one
of
the women
I interviewed. You know, paperless. I mean, you know, growing up in the United States, we don't even have papers. You know, we get a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
We have a birth certificate. But, you know, I'm wondering if when you say papers, do you mean something totally different, though, right?
Well, what I mean really is that this woman has no right to work in the country she is born, educated, have lived all her life in. She has no right to travel because she has no paper saying her name, picture, you know, any ID.
Right, right.
She has no ID because the mother cannot give an ID. And since the father, let's say, was absent, or in this case was a Palestinian citizen with no paper because he's a refugee in Lebanon, so she is without papers. Papers meaning precisely that you have, you know, something to show because...
just to say who you are. So does that also mean she probably can't go to school either?
Well, she did go to school, but after that it became very complicated. And I even tried to help her, you know, find work because this is a very educated girl. She's gone to the same school I've been to. She's has a very interesting experience, but she cannot legally work, so it's really appalling. I mean, I find it unacceptable.
I don't think most people know about all of this. You know, I know here in the United States, Nicholas Kristof and his wife wrote the book Half the Sky, and they brought some awareness about what women go through in other countries. But I really don't think the vast majority of women know. I mean, look, I talk to women here in the United States that don't even know that there's institutional discrimination against them getting equal pay. You know, I mean, there's so much education that has to be done.
Yes.
For women, it's
yes.
really unbelievable.
And on their rights.
You think about
and,
it.
You know, I think also for that, they have to be more involved. Because otherwise it's hard to move and shake the statu quo if we are not more involved. Because if, you know, these laws are made and applied and decided without our consent.
Right.
And we're not present.
So what
in
what
a way,
is in
we
some
have
of the
a
most
part of responsibility. We have to be more present.
Yes, yes. And we have to stand up for our sisters who don't know they need to stand up.
Yes, and, you know, the Dalai Lama touched on that. And that was kind of a spark for me with this project. Because he said, I'm not sure I'm
it would be Western women
exactly,
who would save,
but that it
help
would be
save the world.
Western women.
Yeah.
And I can see why, because, you know, sometimes it takes really liberating yourself before you can advise
help
anybody.
Right.
On the other hand, I'm not even taking it like to the T like that, but I think every woman who has liberated herself, whether she's in Africa, the Middle East, or what, just by her presence emanates that. I feel it when I meet these women,
yeah,
you know, and somehow in their presence they give me not only the permission to be that, but they're creating more of that space, and that's what I'm trying to contribute
to. Do with
to.
Your film.
Yes.
Well, are you going to interview, I always get the country in Africa confused, but what was the country in Africa where the women stood up and said they had to have peace? And, you know, they took it to the warlords and they...
Oh, in Liberia.
In Liberia. And didn't one of those women end up in Congress, in the Congress of Liberia?
Actually, you know, this is what brought the first woman president to Liberia. This is really, I think, was really what happened just before Ellen Johnson Sirleaf became the first African woman president, is that the women... in Liberia, which was under dictatorship, really took two parts from both sides of the conflict, forced the conflict makers to have a meeting and sort it out. And they were having a sit-in all around, the mothers and the sisters and the wives, and in a way telling them that they could not get out until they sorted out, that it was
right.
No longer acceptable to go back to conflict. And,
right.
You know, that was a very powerful statement, very powerful
statement. Have you ever
statement. And I think it led the way to having a woman such as Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who really eradicated corruption within a few years from the Liberian government and brought on a lot of women on board to rebuild the streets and the basic structure of the country.
I know this might sound crazy. There's a Greek story about this, but I've often thought if women would tell men, look, you're not going to have any sex until you just stop all this
mm-hmm.
shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
If they could really get by with doing that,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it might change a certain percentage of the men on the planet.
Certainly, but you know, Karen, that brings us back to precisely the core issue, that if women were able to stand for themselves in some
yes.
parts of the world, they
yeah.
could maybe do that. I'm afraid that when they are so constantly, you know, abused and disposed
yeah.
of and objectified, that they don't find that yet.
They would
in
get
themselves,
killed.
In
if,
large
if they
numbers.
Yeah.
I hope that
yeah,
some of them do, but not in large numbers to actually impact the current conflicts we are living. I love that idea. I always felt very inspired by it. And always thought that, yes, because in a way we so underestimate our power. And, you know, our natural contribution is creating more beauty and harmony and we have the power to tilt these things, but we ignore it. And that's why also I wanted to amplify the voices of the women speaking up and not ignoring it, because we can no longer afford to ignore it.
Right. Well, so Sula, I know you've, I'm reading your bio again. I know you've done the film Beirut Rising, covering the first Arab Spring in Beirut in 2005. And
mm-hmm.
now you're working on this, you know, the unheard feminine voice in the Middle East. How
mm-hmm.
far along are you? Is that documentary done? Can it be seen? Or are you still in the process?
I actually showed it only twice as a work in progress. Once at the first Women Artist Biennale in Tuscany, in Italy, this summer, in June, and the second time at Carla and Lee's in Malibu. It is still a work in progress. I still have four women to film before the film is finished. I wanted to let people in, you know, on the process, and also show some of the women I already filmed, but the film will really be finished at the end of the year. I'm returning to complete it. and we'll be editing and hopefully releasing it for International Women's Day in March.
Great. Well, when will you keep my email address? And when
yes.
this is finished,
absolutely.
Let me know. And you know,
absolutely.
You can, yeah, come back on the show and talk about it, and also let us know how we can see it as well.
Thank you. I'm sure that I will have something, maybe simultaneously, because you know, one of my one of the ideas I'm toying with is actually on International Women's Day to be able to release it in maybe a dozen Arab countries at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be interesting just to like raise that voice simultaneously. And maybe in Los Angeles as well.
I will definitely
stay in touch, because I would like also to follow up on your feminine pursuits.
Okay, absolutely. That would be fun. I actually have two books coming out next year, and I'm actually trying to get some sort of either a documentary or a TV series going myself about the feminine face of God around the world, because I feel like the more women who understand that the divine feminine has been swept beneath the rug, the more women, I think it's a tool of empowerment. You know, whether you look at the divine feminine as a real deity, or you look at the divine feminine as an archetype, or you just look at the ideals of the sacred feminine, you know, those are powerful tools in our toolkit to help women rise up and, you know, claim their authenticity, their place in the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
I cannot wait. And, you know, if there's any way I can contribute, collaborate, or just witness, I would love to know about...
Well, thank you. I will share that with you. You know, I'm at the point where I have talked to several production companies, and you know, it's just a matter of connecting the right people together. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we can talk more on the phone or email, but thank
well,
you for
my
your
intention,
interest too.
Karen, is also through this, you know, to spark a lot of creative collaborations.
Yes.
With other women, because I was invited by a woman artist to participate in a creative way like that to that Biennale in Arezzo. She has like a not too dissimilar project than mine, but through painting portraits.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it wonderful to be able to collaborate on creating, you know, more visibility for these different ways of expression. I just feel that we also need men and women to hear more, you know, women's stories, because they tell more personal stories and
yeah, you
from
put
a different point of view.
Yeah,
and we need that as much, you know, than the other, the unbalance that's been happening, be it in the film industry, the music industry, or any corporation, it just has to end. It's another, you know, we're in another era now.
Right.
We have to catch up with that. And I think we women are aware of that and
yes.
all trying to find a way to share it with more people.
Absolutely. Well, Sula, if any of my listeners wanted to, I mean, do you have any trailers or anything like that? Do you have a website that they can see anything yet? Or is that coming down the road?
Well, for the Unheard Feminine Voice of the Planet, definitely it's in the making and it should be up, and I will let you know. Unfortunately for Beirut Rising, because it had been censored in Lebanon and forbidden from broadcasting, I haven't put things online because it's a safety issue.
Okay.
But I will keep you posted on, as I'm liking the sharing the work in progress. I'm having an idea about actually being much more sharing of the making of. So
okay.
maybe in the next few months, and I will keep you posted, I will put things online that are little bits of the women I am filming.
Okay. Well,
or I will be filming in the next month, few months, yes.
And, well, and feel free if you get any links to just put them on my Facebook page or pop them over to me on an email.
I will.
Okay. Well, Sula, before I say goodnight, is there anything else you maybe wanted to share with listeners before you go?
You know, maybe just how initially I was really triggered and inspired by Miriam Makeba. I like to say that because it's really filming her in a concert, and I do film a lot of world music. I have been for many years, and in a concert where I was filming her, she took the time between songs to talk to the people. And there was a really powerful woman, so authentic, so at ease, so spontaneous, really having a conversation with 5,000 people. And the silence in the audience was amazing. And she was teasing them and pushing their buttons, and I loved it. And I just felt, wow, if only I could amplify this. And
right.
Voila, it's really the link. And
she inspired
it's a spark.
You.
Yes, it's the spark that made me think, what if? And here I am. Before I know it, I'm in the core of it and doing it. And
people
and
will
delighted.
Be doing that very same thing to you when they watch your, you know, you will be speaking to them through your film. So
I hope so. That, you know, totally my desire to share what inspired me with many other people, and each one of this woman I found really, could be the subject of a whole documentary by herself.
Uh-huh,
and,
yeah.
And initially, to be honest, the way Feminitude grew was from one film where I was going to amplify some amazing women voices from all over to 8 films because there are so many.
So many. Well, that's good. That's really
yes,
good
and
news.
And I thought, and, you know, why limit it to one woman
absolutely.
Per culture, maybe a film per culture?
Well, it sounds wonderful to me, and thank you for being so inspired and so talented and so dedicated to serving women around the world. I think it's wonderful, and I'm so glad you were on the show tonight. Thank you for making the time
you.
For me.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you very much for all you bring to us.
Well, thank you, Sula, and stay in touch, okay?
I will.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I just wanted to tell you that I hope you'll tune in next week when I actually have 2 shows. On Wednesday, I'll be chatting with Matthew Fox and Adam Bucco about their new book, Occupy Spirituality. It's a radical vision for a new generation. And Thursday, Sam Daly Harris is with me to discuss Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Governments. And with the holidays around the corner, I hope you don't mind asking you to please consider one of my books for your friends and loved ones. If you haven't heard about it yet, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. It was a finalist in the USA National Best Book Awards. It's divided into 4 sections that reflect the elements of Mother Nature, earth, fire, water, air, and then, of course, spirit. The earth section talks about traveling to sacred sites, detailing our experiences there. Air section is about honoring goddess, hearing her whispers of inspiration. Fire is about our passion and even politics in women's communities. Water is about our emotions, having love for ourselves and how important ritual is. There are rituals, meditations, prayers, lots of great information in the book, including details of very magical happenings in my life using prophecy and prayer. My other book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which Sula was talking about with me tonight, that was my first book. It's received rave reviews because, you know what, there really isn't anything like it out there. So many goddess places between two covers, both living in ancient traditions. So whether you're an actual traveler to sacred places in faraway lands or you travel there from your armchair, this book would be useful to you. This is the book that got me in so many places to talk about goddess. It's really goddess through the back door of travel. You know, I was fortunate enough to travel across 5 continents chasing down sacred sites, and I bring it back home to you to raise awareness of the many faces of goddess across continents and cultures, as well as herstory and what's happening in these places yesterday and today. So again, I hope you'll consider either of these books for your library or for your friends. You can get them from my website, KarenTate.com, where I have a special, both books for $25 plus shipping and handling if you're in the United States. Or you can get the books in any local or online bookseller as well. But if you get them from me, I can sign them for you. So thank you so much for listening to the show tonight. And I'd like to close with one of my famous quotes. I've been sharing it with you a lot because I think it is so powerful. It really sort of ties into what we were saying tonight with both of my guests about the many ways women empower themselves and fight the patriarchy and, you know, find ways to be their authentic selves and not have someone's boot on their throat. Anyway, this quote is from Monique Wittig, and it goes like this. There was a time when you were not a slave, remember that. You walked alone, full of laughter. You bathed bare-bellied. You say you have lost all recollection of it. Remember. You say there were no words to describe this time. You say it does not exist. But remember. Make an effort to remember. Or failing that, invent. Yes, indeed. Failing that, invent. So, as I close tonight's show, with it being the month of October, with Hallows and Samhain upon us, I think I'll close the show with something by Abigail Spinner McBride called Passing Through the Portal. Good night, listeners, and thank you for being the gas in my tank, and please tune in next Monday and Thursday. Good night.
At this time of Samhain, when the veils between the worlds are thin, through the power of one mind, with the pure love of one heart, we open a portal to the other side. We peel back the veil, and we call to those of our ancestors and beloved dead who would like to experience this time of magic with us. We invite them to be fully present in this sacred space, to see through our eyes, to move through our bodies, to speak through our words, and to dance in this space with us, until we close our circle, when they will return across the great divide. We welcome the ancestors. Blessed be. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. That which is remembered never dies. 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 All things change. All things change. All things change. All things change. That which is remembered never dies. That which is remembered never dies. That which is remembered. the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn.